Welcome to another deep dive. We've got a really fascinating set of materials today, all about Old Testament history. Specifically, we're looking at the timeline of the patriarchs. That's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in case anyone forgot. We're talking lectures, commentaries, even some archaeology thrown in for good measure.
It's incredible how these figures from thousands of years ago can still spark so much debate and discussion.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think we're in for some serious time traveling today as we try to untangle the chronology of this period. Who knows, we might even stumble across some surprises along the way.
Well, I'm already a little surprised, honestly. The first thing that jumped out at me in all this material is this whole debate about the 430 years the Israelites supposedly spent in Egypt before the Exodus.
Ah, yes, the 430-year question. It's a classic.
It seems like figuring out exactly how long they were actually there is like the key to understanding when Abraham and the other patriarchs actually lived.
You're absolutely right. That's one of the biggest challenges we face when trying to reconstruct this period. I mean, Exodus 12.40 clearly states that the Israelites were in Egypt for 430 years.
Okay. So far, so good.
Right. Seems pretty straightforward. But then you have the Septuagint. You know, that ancient Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible.
Right.
It adds a little something to that verse. It says the Israelites were in Egypt and Canaan for 430 years.
So are we talking about, like, cutting the time in Egypt in half if we go with the Septuagint? What does that even mean for figuring out when the patriarchs were around?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Some scholars stick with the traditional understanding of Exodus 12.4, the plain reading, you could say, and argue for a full 430 years in Egypt. They have some good points, you know. They point to verses like Genesis 15.16, where God tells Abraham that his descendants will return to Canaan in the fourth generation.
Okay, but how does that support 430 years in Egypt?
Well, think about it. If four generations have to pass before the Israelites return to Canaan after being in Egypt, a longer stay in Egypt allows more time for all those generations to happen.
So more time in Egypt means more Israelites to make that Exodus so dramatic.
Exactly. More time for that huge population growth the Exodus story implies. But of course, not everyone agrees with that interpretation. There are other scholars who lean towards a shorter stay in Egypt, more like 215 years.
Hold on. Are we saying that the Bible contradicts itself?
Well, not necessarily. It's more a matter of interpretation. And, you know, we have to remember that we're dealing with ancient texts that have been copied and translated over centuries. It's not surprising that some variations have crept in along the way.
Okay, but what about the scholars who go for the shorter time frame? What are they basing that on?
Good question. They often point to Galatians 3.17, which seems to suggest a time frame closer to 215 years from Abraham to Moses.
Okay, I'm starting to see how this gets complicated. So how do we even begin to sort this out?
Well, luckily, we have some brilliant minds who have tackled this problem. One scholar whose work I found particularly insightful is K.A. Kitchen. You actually included some of his writings in the materials you sent.
Right. I was intrigued by his take on all this. It seemed to thread the needle between those two interpretations.
Yes, exactly. He offers a really interesting way to reconcile those seemingly conflicting timelines. Kitchen argues that when Paul, the author of Galatians, mentions that 430 years, he wasn't talking about the entire period from Abraham to Moses.
So what was Paul referring to then?
Kitchen suggests that Paul was actually referring to a specific, well-known block of time within a larger time frame, like focusing on a certain chapter within a longer book, you see. So Paul wasn't saying that the whole journey from Abraham to Moses lasted 430 years, just a significant portion of it.
Okay, so that would actually allow for a longer total sojourn, including the time in both Canaan and Egypt, while still taking into account that 430 years mentioned in Galatians. I like it. It's like a compromise that allows us to fit all the pieces together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's worth pointing out that the Samaritan Pentateuch, another ancient version of the first five books of the Bible, also adds, and Canaan, to Exodus 12.40, just like the Septuagint.
So it's not just a one-off translation quirk then?
Nope. It seems like there was a pretty solid tradition supporting that longer time frame.
Mm-hmm.
So as you can see, we've got multiple interpretations of these key verses, each with its own set of implications for the dating of the patriarchs. It's a real detective story.
It is, and it makes you realize how much careful thought and analysis goes into reconstructing these ancient timelines. It's not just about blindly accepting one interpretation over another. It's about weighing the evidence, considering different perspectives, and being willing to be surprised by what we find.
Absolutely. And speaking of surprises, there's another fascinating piece of this puzzle that we haven't even touched on yet. If we look closely at the genealogies in the Bible, specifically the one tracing the line from Levi to Moses in Exodus 6, it might hold some unexpected clues about the length of the Israelite sojourn.
Okay, I'm all ears. Lay it on me.
Let's dive in. So we've got that genealogy in Exodus 6, right? Tracing the line from Levi all the way down to Moses.
Right, and if I'm remembering correctly, that's supposed to cover four generations, right?
You got it. Four generations spanning those potentially 430 years we were just talking about. Which, you know, if you think about it, seems a little tight for all that to happen.
Yeah, now that you mention it, four generations in over four centuries does seem like we're cramming a lot in.
Exactly, and that's where things get really interesting. Because the traditional way of reading Exodus 6.20, the verse about Amram being Moses' dad, it assumes it's a direct father-son lineage, no gaps.
Yeah.
But what if that's not the whole picture?
Okay, you've definitely got my attention. What are you thinking? Like some secret, hidden generations?
It's not quite secret, but maybe not so obvious either. What if Exodus 6 isn't giving us like a complete family tree, you know, with every single ancestor listed? What if it's more like highlighting the big names, the key figures in Moses' clan?
So like a condensed version?
Exactly. And that would open up the possibility of having more generations between Levi and Moses than we might initially think. It could stretch out that timeline and maybe help explain those tricky chronological differences we've been wrestling with.
Ah, so those missing generations could be the key to solving the 430-year puzzle. That's pretty clever.
And there's another thing to consider, too. Remember all those Amramite men mentioned in Numbers? Over 8,000 of them at the Exodus. Well, it's kind of hard to imagine that many descendants popping up in just four generations. It's a lot of people.
Yeah, 8,000 does seem like a pretty big family reunion for just four generations, even with all that multiplying going on.
It does, right. Yeah. And it supports the idea that maybe we need to think about a longer time frame. Maybe there were more generations tucked in there than the Exodus genealogy spells out for us.
Okay, so we're looking at potentially more generations, a longer time frame, the 430 years maybe covering both Canaan and Egypt. Man, this is way more complex than I realized.
It is. It just shows how we have to be careful about making assumptions. We can't just take those biblical genealogies at face value, especially when we're trying to reconstruct a timeline that stretches back thousands of years.
It's like a puzzle with some missing pieces.
Exactly. But even with those missing pieces, we can still see some pretty amazing patterns emerging. And those patterns can tell us a lot about the world the patriarchs lived in, the customs, the laws, even the societal norms that shaped their lives. And that's what's so fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's one thing to talk about timelines, but it's another thing entirely to try to imagine what life was actually like back then. So what kind of cultural details do we find in those sources that can help us bring this period to life? Anything that might strike us as odd or surprising today?
Oh, definitely. For example, one thing that we might find a bit strange is the practice of childless couples adopting a servant as their heir. Remember, Abraham and Sarah initially planned to make their servant Eliezer their heir before Isaac came along.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I always thought that was just a plot device, you know, to create some drama in the story.
Well, it turns out that this wasn't just a random story element. It reflects real legal practices of the time. We know this thanks to those incredible Nusi tablets you included in the materials. Those tablets, for anyone who doesn't know, are basically a treasure trove of information about ancient Near Eastern law.
I was blown away by those, honestly. It's like they give us a direct window into the legal system that Abraham and Sarah would have been familiar with.
Exactly. And they reveal that this kind of adoption, where a servant could become the legal heir, was totally legit. The tablets actually outline all these specific rights and obligations involved for everyone. So it wasn't just some made-up thing in the Bible. It was a real legal practice grounded in the customs of the time.
It's amazing how these seemingly small details from the Bible connect with actual historical records. It's like those records are confirming what we read in the text.
It really does make the story come alive in a new way. And speaking of ancient customs, remember how God makes that covenant with Abraham in Genesis 15, promising him descendants and land? And then to seal the deal, God does this, well, kind of bizarre thing.
Oh, yeah. God passes between the halves of some sacrificed animals. It's a pretty vivid image, but honestly, I never really understood what was going on there. Was it some kind of magical ritual? A blood sacrifice?
Well, it might seem strange to us, but in the ancient Near East, making a covenant or treaty was often accompanied by this very symbolic act of dividing animals. Both sides would walk between those divided halves, and it signified that they were agreeing to the terms. It was like a super serious way of saying, I promise.
So by doing that, by walking between the halves of those animals, God was basically showing Abraham, in a way he could understand, that this promise was for real. It wasn't something to be taken lightly.
Precisely. It was God, in a sense, speaking Abraham's language, adapting to the customs of the time to communicate in a way that would have been both powerful and familiar.
That makes a lot more sense now. So we've got these ancient legal practices and these dramatic covenant ceremonies. But what about the role of women in all this? Were they just silent partners in this patriarchal society? Or do they have any say in things?
That's a great question. And it's one that deserves more attention than it often gets. You know, while it's true that in patriarchal societies like the one we're talking about, women definitely held a subordinate position in many ways, the Genesis narrative shows us that they weren't just these voiceless, powerless figures.
Oh, interesting. So they weren't just sitting in the background letting the men make all the decisions.
Definitely not. Take Sarah, for example. She's a strong, assertive woman who's not afraid to speak her mind. She advocates for her son, Isaac. And she even influences Abraham's decisions regarding Hagar and Ishmael. Remember, she's the one who pushes Abraham to send them away.
Yeah, you're right. She's definitely not a pushover. She's got her own opinions and isn't afraid to share them, even with Abraham. So even within this patriarchal system, women had some agency, some power to shape their own lives and influence events.
Exactly. And it makes you wonder, doesn't it? What were the dynamics like within those ancient households? How much power did women actually wield? How do they navigate the social landscape?
It's like we're catching these little glimpses behind the curtain of history, seeing those human relationships play out. It's fascinating. But I'm also curious about how all these insights into patriarchal society, those customs and practices, can help us figure out the actual dates of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We're still trying to pin down that timeline, right?
Oh, absolutely. And here's where those Nusi tablets come back into play. Remember, they shed light on those adoption practices we were talking about. Well, those tablets actually date back to around 1500, 1400 BC.
Okay, so how does that connect to our timeline puzzle?
Well, think about it. If those legal customs, those ones reflected in the Abraham narrative, were still being practiced around 1500 BC, it would make sense that Abraham himself lived sometime before that.
Ah, so it pushes the patriarchal period back even further.
Exactly. And remember that whole debate about the Philistines and whether or not Abraham could have encountered them? Well, if those Nusi tablets are from around 1500 BC, it strengthens the argument that the patriarchal period predates that commonly accepted arrival date of 1200 BC for the Philistines.
So we're getting a clear picture here. It seems like all these different threads, the biblical texts, the archaeological findings, even ancient legal documents, are starting to weave together to tell a more complete story.
Absolutely. And that's what makes this whole exploration so exciting, right? Mm-hmm. We're not just talking about dry dates and timelines. We're piecing together the lives and world of real people who lived thousands of years ago. We're reconstructing their history, their culture, their struggles, their triumphs.
It's like we're on an archaeological dig, carefully brushing away the centuries to uncover these hidden treasures from the past. And with every new discovery, our understanding of the patriarchal period becomes a little bit richer, a little bit more vibrant.
Exactly. And the best part is, this is just the beginning. There's so much more to explore, so many more questions to ask. And who knows what amazing discoveries are still waiting to be made.
I'm ready for the next layer. Where do we go from here? It's like we've been on this incredible journey, like real explorers charting this unknown territory.
I like that analogy. Mm-hmm. And just like explorers, I think we've realized that the more we uncover, the more we realize how much there is still to learn.
Oh, absolutely. But isn't that what makes studying history so captivating? Yeah. It's a constant process of discovery, of challenging our assumptions and refining our understanding of the past. Speaking of which, what are some of the biggest takeaways for you from all this? What's really stuck with you?
You know, for me, one of the most important things I've learned is to not just skim the surface. I mean, the Bible's full of these amazing stories. But if you really want to unlock the depth of those stories, you have to dig a little deeper. You have to pay attention to those little details about customs and laws and even the names of those ancient kings. Because those details, they can really illuminate the bigger picture.
That makes sense. I used to think of the Bible as this separate, almost untouchable thing, you know, like it existed in its own little world. But seeing how it connects with all these other historical sources, like those Nusi tablets and the Amarna letters, it's like suddenly the Bible's come alive for me.
It's like those extra biblical materials give us the missing pieces of the puzzle, don't they? They help us to see the world of the patriarchs in all its complexity. And it's amazing how often they actually confirm the details we find in the Bible.
It's like we're having a conversation across the centuries, getting a glimpse into the minds and lives of people who lived so long ago. So for those of us who want to keep exploring this, where do we even begin? What resources would you recommend?
Well, first and foremost, I'd say approach the Bible with curiosity. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to challenge those traditional interpretations. There are so many great resources out there to help you on your journey. If you're looking for a deep dive into the historical context of the Old Testament, K.A. Kitchen's Ancient Orient and Old Testament is an absolute must-read. He really gets into the weeds, you know, but it's so worth it.
Yeah, his work's been a game changer for me. And what about John Bright's A History of Israel? That one's been on my list for a while. Is it as good as they say?
Oh, it's excellent. A great overview of Israelite history. He covers the patriarchal period in a lot of detail.
Perfect. I'm adding it to my reading list right now.
And if you're interested in archaeology, Joseph Free's Archaeology and Bible History is a fantastic read. He does a great job of showing how those archaeological discoveries connect to the biblical narrative. It's mind-blowing stuff, honestly.
And don't forget about those online lectures you sent over. Dr. Van Noy's lecture was so engaging. It's like a crash course in Old Testament history.
Yes. Those lectures are a great way to get started. And the thing is, this is an ongoing conversation, you know? New discoveries are always being made. New theories are always being proposed. It's a field that's constantly evolving.
So basically, the exploration never ends. Well, to everyone listening, if something we've talked about today sparked your curiosity, don't let the conversation end here. Pick up a book, watch a lecture, maybe even plan a trip to a museum. Who knows? You might be the one to make the next big discovery that changes everything we thought we knew about the patriarchs.
Exactly. And that's what makes studying history so exciting. There's always something new to learn, always a new perspective to consider. So keep asking questions, keep digging deeper, and most importantly, keep exploring.
Well said. This has been a fantastic journey through time, and I, for one, feel like I've learned a ton. Thanks for being our guide.
My pleasure. Always happy to dive into these fascinating topics. Until next time, keep those minds curious.